This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a victory for Mumia Abu-Jamal and fellow prisoners in Pennsylvania. A salute to W.E.B. Du Bois as the grandfather of Black studies. And we'll look at criminal justice in New York City, where anything can land you in jail if you're Black.
But first, the U.S. Justice Department report on why it refused to indict the white cop that killed Michael Brown buys into the argument that the Black teenager didn't put his hands up before Officer Darren Wilson put a bullet in his brain. Corporate media are now questioning the appropriateness of the protest slogan, Hands Up, Don't Shoot. We spoke with Torian Russell, a leader of Hands Up United in Ferguson, Missouri.
What they're actually asking for is a perfect murder. They want a perfect victim. You know, his hands got to be all the way up. Everybody in the world got to know. No ambiguity to it. Nothing. Just a perfect death, a perfect killing. And you're never going to find that because this country not no more standing to even rule on who's being civil, what witnesses are credible, or any of those things. I think that's where it started coming down to. Because they basically backed Bob McCullough and saying that some of the witnesses weren't credible. Some of the autopsies weren't credible. But the people that were there who spoke contrary to what the report said, they're not credible.
So in the absence of the perfect murder, then any excuse will do in terms of killing a Black person?
Any excuse will do. The Incredible Hulk. So Mike Brown walked through a couple shots because the Incredible Hulk. We had a brother that got killed. Tamir Rice, he was a man child, right? He was 12, but he was, 5'7", 190, and made him seem like he was, LeBron or something as a kid. And that his superpower was going to come out and make a toy gun and a real gun. So everybody, if you're a Black person, you're feeble-minded, you're incompetent, and you're lazy when it's convenient. And then on the other hand, when I need to kill you, you become the most powerful entity in society.
Well, what are people in Ferguson saying in terms of their reaction to this Justice Department report and conclusion?
They gave up on the Department of Justice. I think this is it. A week before, we had the Trayvon Martin. I talked to Mike Brown Sr. a couple of days ago. He said it felt like his son had been killed for the third time. So what you have, not only I wouldn't say a disconnect anymore, it's an all-out absence. There's an absence of faith in the Department of Justice and the justice system as a whole. So, that's why we're really saying that the report couldn't find civil rights violations because those are actually human rights violations. So now it's time for us to go back to the UN like we did in November.
All right. And what kind of efforts are underway to do that?
I think we're going to go back on the human rights violations. Of course, we think it's torture and genocide. That are the main things. You can see that in Nine Square in Chicago. You can also see that in Guantanamo Bay. So you can see those Black sites all over the country. We just know of a few. The lack of access to drinking water, the lack of access to land ownership, and how the mortgage or the housing industry is set up. First, they set it up where you couldn't buy a house, period. Then you can get my old house, and then we can redline it and not insure it. So just those small things, along with living in food deserts, living with improper education, I think these are systematic things. I don't think these are haphazardly happening. I think that the United States government is complicit. They're either complicit in the actions of the white supremacists, or they are fully funding and fully pushing this agenda. Either way, these are human rights violations.
So you envision a full court press to embarrass the United States at the very least before the international public?
Of course. I mean, one, to shame them. Two, to shame them in 2015 that contradicts the international policies around what they call democracy. But three, and more importantly, we need accountability and we need some help over here. So the United States government must be held accountable. So hopefully some sanctions or something. But more importantly, that we need resources, and that we need to really find those international allies to be able to help us and hold America accountable.
And I would also assume that you're not going to allow the Justice Department to dictate what slogans you use in your demonstrations.
Of course not. The report is 200 days too late, and I would almost say 500 years too late. I think this is almost the first time that the United States government came close to condemning themselves, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. They have a great PR firm, but we saw through that. And basically what they're saying with unlawful stops, use of force, and using police officers as revenue collectors, what I would say, if it was any other organized crime enterprise, that they were racketeering, and they should be actually charged through the RICO Act, is that these are systematic things that is fueling the economy. It's fueling prison industrial complex. Who are you filling some of these small segregated white communities who left the black community? They only come back as officers or elected officials to create a revenue stream the same way that they did it during the Jim Crow laws, through the Mississippi laws, right after the Reconstruction period.
What's most striking about the report on Ferguson, as was striking about Michael Brown's murder, is how much Ferguson looks like the rest of the United States, where in every city in the country, there are gross disparities in arrests and in ticketing and up and down the criminal justice system.
Of course, that's what they aim for. They laid it out and then acted like Ferguson is an isolated incident. But they know that's a part of that PR firm push and the propaganda that we have a few isolated incidents. This is not the whole country. No matter where you go, if you're black, you're brown, you're a person of color, you're poor, you're oppressed, this is what your community looks like. This is how it's going to be run. And the United States government, at best, will have a weak statement trying to pacify you and lead you towards gradualism.
Eric Holder will be gone probably in a matter of weeks. I guess this is the big cap on his legacy.
I hope they won't be serving champagne at it. You know, at best, they should have some pop or some ginger ale, because it shouldn't be a celebration. He should go quietly off into the dark. He started off talking about race relations and how the country was cowards. They need to have this conversation or this dialogue. The dialogue is yet to happen. He has yet to correct any of these things, these systematic racist systems or programs or regimes or agenda. And the sad part is that Mike Brown and Trayvon Martin will receive the same amount of justice under a black attorney general that Emmett Till received under a white one. So his legacy is no different from any other person who plays a role in this racist system. Blackface in a high place, or first black something, still gets you systematic oppression. So shouldn't be a celebration. Put the U-Haul truck back up to the White House and you can go quietly off into the night.
That was Torian Russell of Hands Up United in Ferguson, Missouri.
New York City's police commissioner Bill Bratton wants to hire an additional 1,000 cops. But Josmar Trujillo of New Yorkers Against Bratton says there are already too many cops in the city arresting too many people for minor infractions under Bratton's broken windows philosophy of policing.
The NYPD is the seventh largest standing army in the world, as Mike Bloomberg once reminded us. And at about 35,000 cops, it's by far the largest police department in the country, and even one of the biggest in terms of cop-to-citizen ratio. So the idea of 1,000 more cops, even in the context of historically low crimes, but more importantly, the deaths of Eric Garner, Nikhai Gurley, and countless others, we saw as not only completely illogical, but just outrageous. We've come together with some campaign partners around the Safety Beyond Policing campaign to say no to the 1,000 cops. So we're working with some Black Lives Matter activists in the New York area and other kind of like-minded allies to make sure that we do everything possible to see that these 1,000 cops don't see the streets in New York.
Well, explain to me what Safety Beyond Policing means. Lots of folks think that being safe means you have a cop looking over you.
Yeah, so that's part of the campaign, is to really kind of unearth that false kind of comparison between a gun and a badge equaling safety. It's pretty simplistic, and it's actually kind of a deadly ideology that has, unfortunately, in New York, been kind of just taken for granted. So when we have in our communities any issues, the city's go-to answer is always to throw guns and badges at it. So if there's a shooting in the area of Brooklyn, for example, they're going to say, you know, we need more cops, we need more heavy-handed aggressive tactics. And it's always been the rationale of people like Bloomberg and people like Bill Bratton and people who are very quick to use law and order in our communities as aggressively as they can. So we're talking about investment in high-poverty neighborhoods as a way to address true causes of crime to the extent that there is crime in our neighborhoods. Some of this crime is fare evasion, performing on the subway. This is not crime. But to the extent that there is real crime in the community does need safety, we're saying that addressing the high poverty conditions in our neighborhood will actually go a long way towards safety. Finding non-cop solutions to domestic violence or to other things that require some kind of attention doesn't require the NYPD. The NYPD is a gang of enforcers who know nothing else but to arrest and to summons people on things, and in many cases kill people. So it's a pretty straightforward and easy campaign that most people in our communities gladly get behind. We don't need all these cops in our neighborhood if our neighborhoods are strong. So one of the banners that we had at our rally said, strong communities make police obsolete. And that's actually a banner that I had seen in Oakland that for the last couple of years that people there had really, I think, first pioneered that term. And so we wanted to connect that from coast to coast and say that across the country, people in our neighborhoods believe that strong communities are the way that you solve community issues, not just continued police states. So we're going to keep rolling with that for the next few months, and we're hopefully going to change the conversation here in the city and then, you know, hopefully add to the national conversation as well, that we know people in Oakland, people in Ferguson, people in L.A. can definitely build with us on.
And in New York City, just like everywhere else, folks are talking, the police are talking, people in power are talking about this concept, community policing. But what exactly is community policing? What's it mean?
I mean, in my opinion, community policing is spin. It's complete just rebranding, repackaging of broken windows. When Bill Bratton was first coming to power, rising to power through the ranks, he packaged community policing with broken windows because he said that communities were asking for broken windows and quality of life crackdowns, that they wanted the graffiti and the turnstile jumpers and all the undesirables, the homeless people, the scary black man on the corner. They wanted all that gone in order to have this orderly, civil city based on these kind of dominant white supremacist views of what's order. So he, you know, I think disingenuously put community and policing together as if we were going to partner together and this is how we were going to clean up the city. Now, for some people in our city, perhaps this is true. They're the ones who are quick to call cops, you know, because they don't like to see a subway performer or they don't like to see, you know, three black men standing on a corner. But we know that there's many, many people in the city who don't see that as disorder. And so this is the battle that we're having, is not allowing community and policing to keep being brought together as like this one, you know, we're just all one city. We're saying, no, police officers aren't accountable for what they do. They're harassing, they're ticketing us, they're criminalizing us in mass, and we need to actually separate community and policing as much as we possibly can and build barriers there. And so part of that is saying we don't want more cops, and we also want to move away from law enforcement, but community policing seeks to do the opposite. So for us, this kind of old term that's been talked about, I think, since even before I was born, is just more spin because the police department is looking to, with the help of the politicians and the misleadership classes, you would say, they're looking to get past all of the volatility and all of these grumblings and these murmurings of a new civil rights movement. They want to get past all that and just rebrand everything so that everyone just says, oh, look, the cops are getting nicer, they're going to be friendly, they're going to work with us, and so we're all one big happy family. But the sad news is that we're not, and we're not going to allow them to rebrand it.
And the cops aren't, in fact, getting nicer either, even cosmetically.
No. I used to have these conversations with people about, like, the good cop, bad cop thing. And then the thing is, in our city, there is no way that you can even talk about a good cop, bad cop, friendly cop, nice cop dynamic and not understand that this is a militarized paramilitary, if you will, institution that takes orders top-down. And so if the policies and the ideas and the philosophies are to aggressively enforce racist kind of practices that target and criminalize black people, I don't care how nice you are, I don't care what a great guy or great woman that you are, this department is geared towards one end, which is broken windows, militarized policing, and the lack of accountability when it kills and maims our people. So that conversation is irrelevant.
Now, the New York City Police Department is not just huge in raw numbers, but also in political influence, influence with the 50-member city council as well.
Oh, it's crazy. We were at the city council hearing yesterday, and in walks council member Jimmy Vaca, a Democrat from the Bronx, and he goes on this thing about how he hates seeing homeless people on his commute and his subway ride, and he can't wait to see things change so that they can be, you know, removed and out of his way. And then comes in Republican from Staten Island, from the really white racist section of Staten Island, comes in council member Stephen Mateo, and he comes in and he says, we need more cops. My community loves cops, so let's just get more cops. And then he walks out. But these guys were essentially parroting the same talking points that Melissa Marjorie, who's seen as like this liberal, progressive, independista, Puerto Rican, really far left politician in the city, who's the speaker, they were all on the same page together. So all of the city council, from a Staten Island Republican to this ostensibly like lefty speaker, they're all on the same page. And that's absolutely due to the immense political power of the NYPD. This is NYPD whose union, whose crazy union boss, basically made de Blasio fall to his knees under political pressure. The NYPD is beyond powerful in this city, and it's high time that, you know, if the politicians aren't going to hold them accountable, then regular people just need to keep rising up and keep standing up to them. And so that's what we're going to continue to do.
Josmar Trujillo of New Yorkers Against Bratton.
Police Commissioner Bill Bratton claims that a few rogue officers are the root of the NYPD's problem with black and brown communities. But that sounds like a very, very old song to Robert Ganji, director of the Police Reform Organizing Project.
A familiar defense that people who defend police practices will put forward when police wrongdoing is exposed is that it is the act of a few bad apples that's given us all a bad name. And the reality is that it's not particularly the personnel, although individual police officers do behave in brutal and racist ways, it's the policy. And in Ferguson, we can see from the recent Department of Justice report, and in New York City with quota-driven broken windows policing, we see that police officers target low-income people of color, arresting them or ticketing them, sometimes for no good reason, for engaging in low-level infractions. And it is a blatantly racist practice. It compromises the safety and the well-being of people in low-income communities, and it contributes in a dramatic way to the distrust and antagonism that people in low-income communities of color have toward the police force.
So actually, the bad apples are those who promulgated that policy of broken windows.
Yeah, in effect, it is the policy, and again, not the personnel. We at PROC don't even like to personalize it to Bratton, although obviously he, and even more so, Mayor de Blasio, who has ultimate authority, are responsible. It's a politically controversial issue, and they seem to ignore the undeniable evidence that quota-driven broken windows policing is blatantly racist in its effect. The numbers show that, and they're not numbers we make up. They're numbers we often get from the NYPD and other government agencies. 85 to 95% of the misdemeanor arrests in New York City of people of color. The vast percentage, disproportionate percentage of summonses are people of color. And we at PROP go into the courtrooms on a regular basis, particularly to the arraignment parts, where people who were just arrested are brought to be charged with whatever the offense is before a sitting judge. And we see that it is 85% to 95%, again, people of color. Sometimes when we're in the courtroom in the Bronx, Brooklyn, or Manhattan, every person brought before the judge is a person of color. And often the things they're charged with are innocuous activities. It could be things as minor or petty as littering, something called aggressive begging, putting your foot up on a subway seat, carrying an open alcohol container, even though you're not drinking, even though you're not behaving in a disruptive way, riding a bike on the sidewalk, smoking in an unauthorized space. People in New York City get arrested by police officers for those kinds of infractions, and it's virtually always people of color. Those activities have been decriminalized, in effect, in white communities. Whatever the municipal code is, whatever administrative provisions apply to those infractions, they're only enforced in low-income communities of color.
Those infractions are, people could call it, discretionary. You can either look away or you can make a case out of it.
I think that you can't even make a case out of it. You can't make a case out of it that someone should get handcuffed, arrested, confined, actually lose their liberty for a day because you jaywalked or because you littered. I don't think you can make a case for it. I think you could make a case for perhaps being fined or perhaps being told if you threw a piece of paper on the sidewalk to pick up that piece of paper. But to be handcuffed and brought to jail and be treated like a criminal and get a criminal record for those kind of minor infractions, I don't think the police should be involved or law enforcement should be involved in responding to those kind of infractions. There should be other ways, other government agency officials, or even people from neighborhood organizations assigned to address those issues if, in fact, they're highly problematic in a particular community. That kind of thinking should apply to the treatment of mentally ill people, homeless people. All too often, the police are involved in attempting to control, restrain, forcibly remove mentally ill people or homeless people from wherever they're camped at on the street. And what New York City should be providing for homeless people and mentally ill people are social services, mental health services that could help them live a better life, and it could help them find some kind of housing that is more suitable.
That was Robert Ganji of the Police Reform Organizing Project in New York.
Lawyers for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal and other Pennsylvania prison inmates last week won the right to pursue their legal challenge to a bill that would allow victims to sue prisoners whose writings or speech causes the victims mental anguish. The state of Pennsylvania calls it the Re-Victimization Relief Act, but its clear purpose is to silence Mumia Abu-Jamal and other political inmates, many of whom are broadcast on prison radio, directed by Noel Hanrahan.
I think the fact that it was such a direct attack by the Fraternal Order of Police and the legislature and the Governor Corbett, it really means that this information is critical. They know that they cannot keep their policies of mass incarceration, and Pennsylvania certainly is one of a state that is so upset. We have the most lifers, over 5,000. We have the most juvenile lifers. We have the fifth largest death row. We have judges selling kids for cash. I mean, we have scandal upon scandal, and we have the legacy in Philadelphia of Rizzo and a Fraternal Order of Police that's really jackboot. So they know that they cannot keep this level of oppression going if they don't silence prisoners. Prisoners are becoming a class in and of themselves. They're very much articulating their concerns, their needs, their voices. Prisoners' family members are getting organized in this state. So we really see it as a testimony to the fact that the power of prisoners and their humanity is growing.
You've assembled an impressive roster of talent. You put out a good amount of commentary and news every week. But how has this legislation affected different outlets' receptivity to playing your reports?
You know, over the years, we've had a lot of censorship. And it's happened very consistently because the right wing in the Fraternal Order Police, the powers that be, the people that are controlling the mass prison expansion, the funding, really the people that are just crushing poor people in this country, they know that these voices are important. So when National Public Radio hired Mumia back in 1994, Bob Dole got up on the Senate floor and lambasted National Public Radio and threatened their funding. That has happened to us consistently throughout our work. HBO was threatened. Addison Wesley was threatened for publishing Mumia's book. So this happens a lot. Now, when we see it happen, it's chilling. It's chilling to those of us who create the content. It's chilling to the prisoners. It's also chilling to the journalists who know then where the line is. You know, I had one journalist in NPR tell me, hey, they do this every couple of years just to show people where the line is and what the line is they can't cross. That if they want to work at NPR, if they want to work in mainstream journalism, if they wanted to keep their jobs, they know how far they can go. So we see this again this year in 2014. It means that the reach of people's voices and the real honest grassroots, down home, important voices that we need to hear, those are getting throttled and choked. And we are fighting back. I mean, one of the things that happened when we were first censored way back, when Mumia's first book was coming out, I was determined to make sure that Mumia's voice could be heard. The culture would be very different. Like even Ellen Weiss at NPR said, my audience needs to hear Mumia Abu-Jamal. We are facing mass incarceration like we've never seen it before. This was in the days when it was just rolling out. Now, if people had heard his voice and he was on death row, we were executing a lot, the country was having an epidemic of executions. If we really heard Mumia from that perspective on NPR, on 490 stations, reaching 7 to 10 million people in Canada and Mexico and Hungary and South Africa and here, we may not have had the crisis that we're facing now, the crisis of mass incarceration, if we were able to hear the humanity of people inside. So I think it's super important to continue to amplify these voices. They are our brothers, our sisters, our mothers, our cousins. These are our people. We cannot leave them behind. And they're brilliant.
Your roster of reporters and commentators grows with Mumia as a model. Do we see a larger number of people in prison wanting to be like Mumia?
You know, I think inspired to really find their own voices. I think one thing that happens to some people in prison is that they really get centered. You know, they decide that it's their time to really figure out how they can write. And one of the main ways that people can be present as a human being is to write. So we are able to work with an amazing amount of people who really are grappling with their consciousness and by writing and by reflection. And we see those people, we see those writers. There is an enormous community of prisoners that do amazing things, from painters to people doing amazing things. Wait, you would be surprised at the things that are happening inside that are incredible. And the ones that we interact with most are the writers. And we're finding people who are really have something to say, have a lot to say.
Most civil liberties lawyers say that the Re-Victimization Relief Act ought to get laughed out of the constitutional park. How's the fight going?
Really well. Last Thursday, we were in federal court in Harrisburg, and the chief judge of the district heard the case. He limited our hearing only to standing and ripeness, meaning do we have the ability to bring this case to federal court now. The other side, the district attorney and the attorney general who we are suing, they were really intent to try and have it dismissed at the get-go on a technicality because they do not want to be in court defending this. They, in fact, said, we take no position on the constitutionality of this law. So they aren't happy to be in court, but we have to be in court because even from the bench, the judge said to the district attorney's representative, wouldn't it be political suicide for the Philadelphia district attorney not to sue Mumia and Prison Radio? And the assistant ADA said, hey, I'm not elected. I can't say. But it was clear from the question that we are to be expected to be silenced and censored as journalists, as listeners, and also they're going to try and take away Mumia's pencils and pens and all of our other Pennsylvania correspondents when they don't like what they say.
What are you citing or are you prepared to cite as the chilling effect that has occurred because of this legislation so far?
You know, it's interesting because sometimes the state doesn't give you the privilege of showing you how they're censoring you, right? So I can tell you how it occurs to me. All the radio reports that have appeared an hour of Marty Moskowain on WHYY talking about this issue never once plays Mumia Abu-Jamal. How is that journalism? An hour talking about Mumia, the commencement speech, the bill, and they never play him once. Well, that's just like self-censorship in the extreme. A broadcast outlet called me. I'll tell you an example, explicit example of it. And they said, we're small. We distribute to hundreds of stations, but we're pretty small. We have to go to our board of directors and get clearance because we do not want to be sued. We cannot afford to be sued. They have not played him since. They called me in October. They have not picked up Mumia since. And they also said, we're going to advise our outlets in Pennsylvania of the marks when we send out our broadcast, our half-hour show, when they can cut him out if we do air him, how they can go in and cut him away in order to not be sued. And there are other chilling effects. Right now there's a prisoner who is before the Attorney General. He's innocent, and he's advocating to be released. He was declared innocent. He was released from prison. The Supreme Court overturned his case on a technicality. He went back into prison. He's applying to the Attorney General for release. He would be chilled. It would probably not be a good idea for him to be outspoken at this point because he's trying to get relief from these very institutions that have the ability to sue him.
And you multiply this by all of the beefs in all of the prisons.
That's right. It was signed by a governor. The governor has commutation opportunities. That's the only way lifers in Pennsylvania, life without possibility of parole is the only life sentence. We have 5,000 lifers. Every single one of them has to go through a commutation process at this point in order to get out, or a parole board process. If you are talking about what's really happening in the prisons, if you're talking about what the American public needs to know, and the prisons are a very shut down, closed down place, they do not let reporters in generally. I mean, it's hard to get the information out of there. We need people on the inside to talk to us. We have to exercise our role in this democracy by bringing information to the people. And they're trying to shut it down. That's exactly why this legislation is going forward, is because there have been so many whistleblowers inside.
Have other states tried to emulate Pennsylvania?
Not yet. But in the Attorney General's briefs and in the District Attorney's reply briefs, they say that this is the front lines. This is the first of its kind. And there has been a lot of talk about expanding it and seeing if they can make it promulgate across the country.
So when you go to court, you're not just fighting for the rights of prison radio's reporters and commentators and Mumia Abu-Jamal, but for all the potential radio reporters and writers out there in the American gulag.
Absolutely. And there's no reason why we shouldn't have more prisoners on the air. They are first person. There's no, like, filter. There's no talking head interpreting what they think. There are phones in those prisons. There are ability to get into those prisons. We need those voices in the news stories. We cannot cover this culture. The whole entire culture is affected by what happens in prisons. But we can't cover the prison story, which is one of the biggest stories in America, without those first-person, on-the-ground voices. We're not doing our job as journalists if we don't get those voices into the mix.
Obviously, the people who are the filters for the prison story, who now fear to play the voice of Mumia, aren't the proper people to tell that story.
We all need to step up, you know, every single one of us, from people writing letters to the editor, people writing online comments, to journalists, to, you know, expanding the ability of what news we get. I mean, yes, you know as well as anybody that the way our news is contracting in the mainstream, we have to just take it upon ourselves to actually get these stories done. I mean, that is what prison radio does. That's why prison radio is independent. I'd rather be working at a regular radio job, but it takes all my time and energy to make sure these voices are present. A regular radio job wouldn't give me the latitude to make sure they're there.
And it takes time and energy to raise the funds to keep this thing going. How can people be helpful to prison radio?
We've been really successful in building an independent base, but that means every single person that helps us makes it possible to hear Mumia Abu-Jamal. Every single one, every $35 donor. We were just able to get 630 people to fund our Indiegogo campaign, and we wrote a check for $25,000 to the lawyers to make this defense case happen. Prison Radio's defense fund was born. We're working it. We're actually also in a lawsuit in Ohio called Hanrahan versus Moore that is advocating for cameras to get into death row into the Lucasville 5. So we're going to win that case, I believe, as well. So we are advocating for getting those voices out so people can help us. Help us produce the audio that we do every week. Help us produce the frontline Prison Radio Defense Fund work. And they can do it by going to prisonradio.org, www.prisonradio.org. The Defense Fund is the top, has a top sidebar, and then any donate button will get you to our donation platform. We give you information. When you donate to us, you get postcards, you get posters, you get Mumia commentaries, you get a lot of stuff for it because we really believe in this organizing with people and giving them information so that they can work in their communities.
Noelle Hanrahan, Director of Prison Radio.
The voice that Pennsylvania prison officials most want to silence is Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner. He submitted this commentary for Prison Radio.
Every day, every night, through various media, we feed on fear. We feast on it. It matters not the measure, nor its girth. We devour it, for we cannot get enough. So-and-so is coming. ISIS threatens, and we munch our muffins of terror. The nation throws billions into government and private security and ends up more insecure than ever. New barriers are built. Cameras click on more and more street corners. More doors are locked, and fear grows. Since 9/11, a kind of madness erupted in the country. And after all is said and done, all the wars, all the carnage, all the loss has led to little more than pixie dust. Nothing. Newscasts have become fear casts as government and media converge to sow dragon's teeth of fear into the minds of millions. Coming up next, new threats. The road taken by this nation after 9/11 led to this mad, fear-drenched hour. It could only have led to this, for fear can only lead to fear. It feeds governments. It fuels media. It devours reason. Yet it grows, eating us as we eat it. And we are still not full.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania.
Until last year, Dr. Anthony Montero was a professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Montero is a noted scholar of the works of W.E.B. Du Bois and wrote an essay for Black Agenda Report titled W.E.B. Du Bois and the Radicalization of 21st Century Black Studies. Montero says Du Bois can be considered the grandfather of Black Studies.
I think that would have to be the case. He founded a second department of sociology in the nation, but the first department of sociology in the modern sense of empirical and ethnographic sociology. He set up a sociological laboratory. He conducted annual Atlanta University conferences, and he did all of this while encouraging his students to do more and more sophisticated research on the Black South. In fact, he is the first social scientist who, in the modern empirical sense, studied the South. So in that sense, he saw Black studies, or what he was doing at Atlanta, which was in effect Black studies, as an arm of the struggle for Black freedom.
That's very interesting that you point out he urged his students, and of course he himself studied the Black South. His political nemesis, Booker T. Washington, used to rant and rave against people like W.E.B. Du Bois, who he said didn't know anything about the South and should stay out of the black South's business.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And, you know, one of the important features of the Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois debate is over the question of black leadership. And Du Bois said that either black people would produce their own leadership, which was accountable to them and their institutions, or they would be led by white folks. And, of course, that which determined in Du Bois's mind what constituted leadership was not whether or not you were in white media, but your intellect and what you knew about black people, and that's what was in your head and what was in your heart in terms of your commitment to black people and the sacrifice that you were prepared to make for black people. That's why he saw the historically black colleges and universities as a training ground for generation after generation of cadre of black leaders. Booker T. Washington, who said that all the black people needed was education, which would pretty much prepare them to work for white people, did not see the need to produce an intellectually developed and politically committed and ideologically clear cadre of black people who would, in effect, constitute leadership. And by leadership, again, Du Bois did not mean a leader or people who were beholden to white philanthropy. What he was talking about is creating generation after generation of people who would work at the grassroots level, at the city level, state level, national level, and even international level on behalf of black freedom.
Sounds like he was talking about something we could describe as education for liberation.
Absolutely. And he saw black scholars and intellectuals as having to be organically connected to the struggle for freedom. That's why in 1948, when he looked back at what he in 1903 called the Talented Tenth, he said the Talented Tenth had failed, that they had become seduced by the white world and materialism, and to use his words, had been consumed by universal selfishness. He therefore, in 1948, called for the crystallization or the formation of a guiding 100. Well, rather than 1 in 10, he said 1 in 100 would have all of the qualities which would constitute them as a leadership class.
So here we have Du Bois doing this groundbreaking work at Atlanta University between 1897 and 1910, laying the ground for black studies as we know it, but we don't get black studies until the mid-60s.
Well, that's black studies in white universities. There was black studies in black universities and schools going back to the mid-1900s. The first important one, in fact, at its height, was led by a woman here in Philadelphia named Fannie Jackson Coffin, and that was known as the Institute for Colored Youth. And they served a dual function. Interestingly, they taught skills and trades, but they also prepared students to go to the best university in the country, including Yale, and some of their teachers were among the first to have advanced degrees in areas like mathematics. And, of course, if you don't mind me mentioning, the famous Octavio V. Cato, who was one of the pioneers in the struggle for voting rights for black people here in Philadelphia. He was also a teacher at the Institute for Colored Youth, and he was killed by a white mob in the course of galvanizing the black vote. And the Institute for Colored Youth eventually became Cheney University, which trained some of the best teachers and principals and administrators in this area for many decades.
You also mention in your essay some of Du Bois's contemporaries in the early 20th century, Anna Julia Cooper, Alexander Crummell, William Monroe Trotter, and Ida B. Wells Barnett. Some of these folks are better known as journalists, and so this puts journalism in a different light as well, as a kind of Black studies.
Oh, yes, yes. But see, that's that organic connection between the Black Academy and Black, what we could say, propaganda, Black education. Of course, Anna Julia Cooper was a legendary principal and educator in Washington, D.C. Alexander Crummell was a part of the anti-slavery struggle, along with Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. And of course, William Monroe Trotter was one of the early graduates of Harvard University, and he was a journalist, as was Ida B. Wells Barnett, along with being one of the pioneers in the anti-lynching movement. So, you know, there was not this elitist separation between the university, in this case, the Black colleges, and the Black intelligentsia and activism. It was expected at a certain level, if you were educated, you had to give something back to the community. You had to be an exemplar of selfless service to Black people. And they kind of went by the motto, to whom much is given, much is required. That is not the case today, of course.
And today, Black studies at mostly white universities are under grave threat, and at historically Black colleges, many of them seem to have reverted or never left a kind of Booker T attitude towards education.
And you know something, Glenn, that's very interesting what you say. At the white colleges where you have the abundance of resources, and so many of the so-called white colleges are really public institutions that live off the taxpayers' dollars, and a lot of those taxpayers' dollars come from Black folks. But at these white, highly resourced universities, you have the evisceration and the emasculation of Black studies, and it being turned into either a kind of a vocational education and a kind of a preparation for young people to play a subservient role vis-a-vis white people and the white world. That's what you get on one side. Now, of course, that could be dressed up in a dashiki and long dreadlocks and a change of name to something that sounds African or even more ancient, like Egyptian. That's one side, but the preparation for subservience. On the other side, get, like at places like Harvard and the Ivy League, the training to be rank careerist and apologist for white supremacy and for white domination. So those people are credentialed by the elite to serve in elite spaces as apologists for white world supremacy.
You spent more than a decade teaching African American studies at Temple University, which seems to fit some of the descriptions you just gave.
Absolutely. You know, I'm kind of speaking from my own lived experience. The fight that we waged over that time and are continuing to wage has two principal aspects: that African American studies be saved from a kind of white evisceration and emasculation of it, which has at this time the cooperation of the Lefebvre Sante, who is satisfied with the Faustian bargain that he has made with the more conservative, indeed right-wing forces in the university, and he is prepared to allow the department to become an outpost of neo-colonialism and Black neo Booker T. Washingtonism. Students at best will not be scholars and activists or scholar activists, but something more like administrators, Black administrators in the framework of the American empire. We're fighting against that. We're fighting, and the second part of it is that we're fighting to have African American studies and the African-American community, especially here in Philadelphia, be connected. Connected, as Du Bois said, as bone of the bone and flesh of the flesh. That no matter what your degree is, no matter who credentialed you, more than not, if you are black, you are living behind the veil. You are living within the fold of the color line. And so the intellectual academic scholar must commit herself or himself to the ongoing fight for justice and liberation that our black sisters and brothers are waging.
Lots of the young people that applied to Temple University to go to the African American Studies Department thought that they were getting into an activist kind of environment. Right. How are they adjusting to Molefe Asante's regime as chairman?
Well, I can tell you, the brightest of them, the most committed of them, are angry and disappointed. And that rage is being turned into organized resistance and activism. In fact, I have been made aware by them that they're putting forth four demands to the incoming administration of the College of Liberal Arts. And one of their demands is that Dr. Asante be relieved of his post as chairman of the department after this semester. It's an eye-opener for a lot of them. You know, many of the current undergraduates and graduate students, for that matter, thought that the era of activism and militancy was over, and all that they had to be is, you know, the best that they could be in terms of their schoolwork. And now they're realizing that to get a decent education, they're going to have to fight, even at a university that is generously funded by the state of Pennsylvania and given every privilege imaginable by the government of the city of Philadelphia. That these black students, many of them from Philadelphia, a city that is at least 45% African American, have to fight for a relevant education. And that means not only do they have to fight against the current administration and its negligence, but they have to fight against Molefe Asante, who has turned the department into a kind of religious shrine to his ideology.
Philadelphia being the city that W.E.B. Du Bois did his famous study of black people in, a study of how black people actually lived, where they lived, and how they made a living.
It's quite ironic, is it not? Quite ironic that in this city with so much history, in fact, going back to the 18th century, and Richard Allen and Absalom Jones and the first black denomination, the Methodist Episcopal Church, the church that Paul Robeson was a member of. So it goes way back. And, of course, Du Bois' landmark study was done on Philadelphia. But, of course, that book is not read at Temple, certainly not in African-American studies. You know, Professor Asante, in a recent lecture, when answering a question of a young graduate student, tried to justify why he does not teach Du Bois. He said Du Bois was not Afrocentric, he was a Marxist. So then one has to list everybody else that he could not teach or would not be allowed on the faculty at Temple, including Paul Robeson, including Angela Davis, and we can go on and on and on. So we have this great history of art, of music, of scholarship, of intellect, of institution building, of theology, just everything that would make this a laboratory for social, scientific, ethnographic, cultural, literary, and on studies of black people. And here you have a department where the best that the chair can offer the students at Temple and the people of Philadelphia is a change of name. This is blasphemy at a level that it's hard to even get your head around.
The change of name being from the Department of African American Studies to the Department of Africology.
Yes, whatever that means. you know, if it goes through, and I, you know, at this point I seriously doubt it, hopefully the combined forces of students in the community would say to him that why would we send students out into the world with a degree from a department that nobody recognizes and knows what it is? No, this is betrayal, and this is selfishness, and it's self-centeredness, and it's egotism, and it's a throwback to a period of medieval feudalism in Africa, and it is the attempt to establish an authoritarian, almost feudalistic worship of one man, as it were, who has a sense of himself that does not fit the reality of who he actually is.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.